Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming live from London. This is Owen Bennett-Jones. Well, President Biden met his successor, Donald Trump, in the White House today, and after all the vitriol of the campaign, when terrible insults were flying around on all sides, there was a strikingly gracious exchange. President Biden's spokesperson said it was cordial and substantive. Mr. Trump said there was discussion of the Middle East. Most of all, that was private. This is what was said in public.
Well, Mr. President-elect and the former president,
thank you,
Donald, congratulations.
Thank you.
And looking forward to having a, like we said, a smooth transition. Do everything we can to make sure you're accommodated, what you need. And we're going to get a chance to talk about some of that today.
So good.
Welcome.
Thank
back.
You. And thank you very much. And politics is tough. And it's, in many cases, not a very nice world, but it is a nice world today, and I appreciate it very much. And a transition that's so smooth, it'll be as smooth as it can get, and I very much appreciate that, Jim.
You're welcome. Thank you all.
Thousands of questions being thrown at them by the media there. None of them answered. They went into private talks after that. And shortly after that, the US media companies made projections saying that the Republicans will win the House of Representatives. So they've got the Senate in the White House and the House, meaning they are now totally dominant in Washington. Also news of new appointments today. In the last hour or so, it was announced that the next Secretary of State will be Florida Senator Marco Rubio. He used to support projecting American power around the world, as the neocons did back in the day, but he's become more isolationist, in line with Trump. In November last year, when he was speaking to members of the anti-war group Code Pink in Washington, he rejected the idea of a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas.
Senator Rubio, will you call for a ceasefire?
No, I will not. On the contrary.
Senator Rubio,
are you filming it?
Wait,
so I want you guys to get this. I want them to destroy every element of Hamas they can get their hands on. These people are vicious animals who did horrifying crimes. And I hope you guys post that.
And what about the civilians that are being killed every day?
Hamas should stop hiding behind civilians, putting civilians in the way. Hamas knew that this was going to lead to this. Hamas should stop building their military installations underneath hospitals.
So you don't care that 15,000 have died? You don't care about the babies that are being killed every day?
I think it's horrifying. I think it's terrible. And I think Hamas is 100% to blame. That's what I think. Make sure you post that, please.
Well, there we are. That gives an indication maybe of what the Middle East policy will look like. As I said, just after that Biden and Trump meeting, all these appointments came through. So let's go live now to the BBC's senior North America reporter, Anthony Zerka. Marco Rubio, first of all. We'll do Elon Musk later in the programme, so don't worry about him. But Marco Rubio, I mean, people were expecting that, right?
Well, yeah, his name had been floated out there as very likely for the past few days. So there had already been some pushbacks from some members of Trump's circle who don't think he's loyal enough to Donald Trump. They noted his criticisms back in 2015 and 2016 and wanted someone like Rick Grenell, who is a little bit more of a hardliner and more embracing of Donald Trump's foreign policy outlook. But Marco Rubio has been an ardent defender of Donald Trump's on television for the past few years. He has, as you mentioned, moved closer to Donald Trump's views on non-interventionism. Although I think one of the big takeaways from Marco Rubio is that he is a China hawk. He has been very critical of China and reoriented American foreign policy towards China. He actually was sanctioned by China after he criticized China's conduct in Hong Kong and with the Uyghur minorities.
That's right. I think there were suggestions that China's social media effort in this campaign did include having a go at Marco Rubio. We should just mention that in a previous sort of iteration of his career, he described Trump as a con artist and shouldn't be allowed to get access to the nuclear codes and that sort of thing. But as Trump said, American politics is pretty rough business. What other appointments have we got? Can you tell us about? There's a defense secretary.
We did get Defense Secretary Pete Hegworth, and he is a Fox News personality. He is an author, a conservative author, kind of a firebrand. I think that surprised a lot of senators, even Republican senators, because he doesn't have the kind of experience with the bureaucracy, with the largest, sprawlingest bureaucracy in American government, the Defense Department. He was a junior officer in the military, a decorated combat veteran, and someone who works in with veterans groups, but more known for being a talking head on a conservative news station than for being able to be familiar with the intricacies of the Defense Department.
Yep. Tulsi Gabbard?
Tulsi Gabbard, Director of National Intelligence. She was a member of Congress, a Democrat, actually supported Bernie Sanders back in 2016, but drifted to the right and ended up leaving the Democratic Party, becoming a Republican, and endorsing and campaigning for Donald Trump this last time around. So she will be involved in advising the president on intelligence matters and coordinating the intelligence agencies from the White House. And of course, the biggest one that just came out was Matt Gaetz, the Republican congressman from Florida, who has now been nominated by Donald Trump to be attorney general. Mm-hmm. That's another one that is opening a lot of eyes in the Senate, which will ultimately be responsible for confirming him. He was on the House Judiciary Committee and was a real firebrand, a conservative firebrand. He's been dogged by ethics investigations, but he has been very critical of the Justice Department. And Donald Trump, in announcing that Gaetz was his pick for Attorney General, said that Gaetz was going to reform the Justice Department to do away with the lawfare and the investigations that have weaponized the Justice Department, in his view. So essentially using Gaetz as a wrecking ball to bring down the Justice Department as we now see it, and reform it in a way that Donald Trump thinks is more appropriate.
Okay, well, thanks very much. That was the BBC's senior North American reporter, Anthony Zerka, on the latest from Washington, where, as I say, they now have the Republicans a clear run with the presidency, the Senate, and the House of Representatives as well. Now, amidst all these foreign policy appointments, there is always the question, what is going to happen in Ukraine? On the campaign trail, Donald Trump said he could solve that conflict in 24 hours, but didn't really go into how he might go about doing that. And then when he called President Putin very shortly after his election victory, Mr. Trump was reported as saying that Russia should not escalate its military action, that's what he told Mr. Putin. So what then are his plans? Well, some analysts are saying that if the Russians secure a favourable settlement for them in Ukraine, then Mr. Putin will inevitably turn his attention to somewhere else, Moldova maybe, Georgia, or the Baltic states. So what does it all look like from those places? Well, Margus Schakna is the Estonian Minister of Foreign Affairs. He's currently in London and dropped into the NewsHour studio. As he looks ahead, is he nervous?
No, we are not nervous. We have been living in this piece of land already 7,000 years, and we know that nothing good is coming from east, so we are used to be prepared. But of course, we don't know exactly what is going to happen, but we are doing our job already, what we have decided like in 1991, that we will never be alone again. And happily, we have NATO troops there, British troops there, US troops, French troops, and we are a member of NATO. But of course, the relation with Donald Trump and U.S. position globally is, I think, that's something but which decides during the next years what will happen.
You know what the theory is, that if Putin succeeds in Ukraine, America withdraws the backing for Zelensky, Putin gets some sort of territorial gain locked in Ukraine. You or Moldova or Georgia are next.
I don't believe that we'll be next in the meeting. I've heard these stories already years, and also I was defense minister when Trump first time entered the office, and everybody speculated exactly what is going to happen. But from the first term, I can say that actually we got more troops, we got more military support, we got more financial support than ever before. But of course, we understand as well that if Ukraine loses or Putin can declare the victory, though, it won't be just peace and longing peace, in the meaning that the new aggression will come as well. We saw after the Minsk agreements. So that's why we are very clear on the position that we need to give the clear security guarantees to Ukraine, NATO membership, and also that any kind of deals without Ukrainians, it's not actually the peace.
Tell us about what Trump means for NATO. I mean, you must have thought about this because NATO is so important to you. And, you know, he's very sceptical about it and he wants European countries to pay more. I mean, you probably agree with him about that.
We agree with him, and we have agreed already many U.S. presidents before that we need to pay more. And Estonia is putting 3.4% of GDP, but all the countries must invest more to defense because we really believe that Russia has an opportunity and maybe even the willingness for the future to invade and to test NATO. It can be Estonia, it can be Lithuania, Poland, Finland. So it is obvious without Trump elections, and we have called as well NATO member states to invest more, and maybe the new level should be everybody a minimum 2.5% of GDP.
Can you tell us what's happening in your country now? There's no military activity now. What other sort of Russian activity is there in Estonia?
Hybrid attacks. We see them in Germany, many other countries, financed and coordinated by the secret services of Russia. So if we put all these hybrid and cyber attacks, we're listing them, and if we put them like 4 years back time, then I think that maybe we would even call like Article 5. So
just to explain, Article 5, you mean when you invoke the common defense that NATO...
Yeah, but if we put just all these actions which Russia is already committing in Europe, I mean not in Estonia only, in the time back like 4 years, we could have been more worried and maybe reacting already. Russia is pushing us, they're pushing the limits, testing our societies. So the invasions, they're not starting anymore as maybe like 100 years ago when, you know, you had military orchestras and, you know, the troops were sent to invade somebody. It's already here, and we must just prepare for the next level.
There's much talk about Trump and NATO. What about Viktor Orban in Hungary, the voices in Europe that are echoing America first, really, sort of Europe first, let's not spend lots of money on defence, let's worry about ourselves. Are you concerned that Europe isn't as solid for you as it used to be?
I'm a very realistic person, and in European Union it's harder and harder to find the consensus about the foreign policy, to make a decision.
It's always been hard.
It's always been hard. But I see as well that Hungary and these some countries, they are more diplomatical in the frame of NATO, which is very concrete defense organization with the commitments. Though I think that this, with Donald Trump as well, that NATO will remain one of the most important priorities as well for US. And also we need to understand that Europe is a strategic partner economically as well to US.
You're basically saying you don't believe Trump will weaken NATO.
I don't believe that NATO will be weakened in the meaning of military capabilities. The question is about the political decision-making processes. And this is something we need to understand, that we don't know exactly what Trump will do.
Thinking ahead to what the Trump presidency might mean for his country, that was Margus Tsahkna, Estonia's Minister of Foreign Affairs. You're listening to the World Service of the BBC. Coming up, the mystery of a beluga whale wearing a harness may finally have been solved.
This white shadow was big and moving towards us. It turned out to be a beluga whale. It was really strange. This region is not natural habitat for beluga whales. I've never seen one in these waters.
That's a little later, and just some other headlines. Donald Trump and President Biden have met at the White House to discuss a smooth transition of power, in stark contrast to the situation 4 years ago. The Republicans have held on to their majority in the House of Representatives, strengthening their ability to deliver Mr. Trump's agenda. And a prominent Iranian human rights activist is reported to have killed himself in Tehran to protest against the rule of Ayatollah Khamenei. You're listening to NewsHour. Now, a month or so ago, our Delhi correspondent, Samira Hussain, reported on the use of bulldozers in India to knock down properties of people accused of or convicted of a crime. Government critics said the method was often used to destroy Muslim homes.
Overcome with grief. This was once Asia Bano's home. Now, a pile of broken dreams. 3 months ago, police accused her husband and 10 others, all Muslim, of having beef, prohibited in most Indian states. The next morning, authorities bulldozed their homes, claiming they were illegal, built on public land.
What pains me the most is that I lost my daughter too.
16-year-old Zenith died of pneumonia just weeks after their home was demolished.
They already took my husband to jail. Why did they have to break my home? If they hadn't, my daughter would be alive.
Convinced, Zenith died because she had no protection from the monsoons.
Well, that was Samira Hussain reporting a while ago, and in response to complaints about this bulldozing, the ruling BJP said nothing is done against the law. But the law has now intervened in the form of the Supreme Court in India, which has ruled that people's properties cannot be demolished by the authorities just because they are accused or convicted of a crime. Now, this ruling quoted a famous British judge, Lord Denning, who in 1964 said, "The poorest man may in his cottage bid defiance to all the forces of the crown. It may be frail. Its roof may shake. The wind may blow through it. The storm may enter. The rain may enter. But the King of England cannot enter. All his force dares not cross the threshold of that ruined tenement." Stirring stuff. Anbarasa Netharajan is our South Asia regional editor.
This has been happening for the last 4 or 5 years, especially in the states ruled by the governing Hindu nationalist BJP. Demolishing illegal structures is nothing new in India, but what has happened in the last 4 or 5 years has been those people who are accused of taking part in communal incidents or violence, or even those who dissented with the government, their houses have been targeted, which the critics and rights activists say the government is trying to crush their courage to speak up by demolishing their house. So it is not happening all over India. It is only a selected few states ruled by the BJP. Now, this has triggered a lot of anger among the minority Muslims. There are about 200 million people, 14% of India's population, the third biggest Muslim population in the world. Now, this is what they're using is what they call the bulldozers, basically the JCB-like machines to destroy these houses. And you know, very soon, the Hindu nationalist rallies, people started parking these JCBs outside as a show of strength, what the Muslims would see as a sign of, a symbol of repression against them. And these even toy bulldozers were taken by the supporters of the Hindu nationalist BJP to show, to assert their supremacy, the Hindu supremacy. However, on the other hand, the BJP governments in various states, they insist that these structures were illegal, they were built without permission or built on public land, and that's why they were taking this action.
And that was Anbarasan Etharajan there. Now, 5 years ago, a huge, pure white, smooth-skinned and apparently rather tame beluga whale swam up to some fishermen in Norway. It was wearing a harness, and there was immediately speculation that it was a Russian spy whale. Well, now, a marine scientist who was working in Russia at the time has told the BBC she's certain the whale escaped from a military facility near Murmansk. Satellite images from there suggest that whales may be being trained to protect nuclear submarines. Our environment correspondent, Jonah Fisher, reports.
It's April 2019, and a beluga whale has surfaced alongside Jor Heston's fishing boat in the far north of Norway.
We saw a white shadow in the water. This white shadow was big and moving towards us. It turned out to be a beluga whale. It was really strange. This region is not natural habitat for beluga whales. I've never seen one in these waters. As it came closer, we saw that it was entangled with something. First, we thought it was a rope or some fishing gear.
In fact, it was a harness, and once Jaw had jumped in the water and freed the whale, attention was drawn to the words written on the harness buckle.
No, there was no cameras on it or anything. It was just like this.
Jürgen Rewig is from the Norwegian Directorate of Fisheries.
And it also says on the small letters on the clips.
Equipment, St. Petersburg.
Equipment, St. Petersburg.
Alan Clough was the first journalist on the scene.
How is this possible? We didn't have any answers. This was supposed to be a fun and warm story about a mammal being freed. But it really dawned on me that this is something far bigger than I've been doing before.
Freed from the harness, the beluga, instead of swimming off, sought out more human contact and took up residence at the harbour of Hammerfest. The whale was given the name Valdemir, a blend of the Norwegian word for whale and the first name of President Putin.
People in Hammerfest was quite proud that the white whale came to them. And then we saw even more advanced tricks.
I could see that people were using GoPros and hope to get underwater footage of the whale.
Eve Jourdain is a whale researcher at the Norwegian Orca Survey.
It was very obvious that this particular whale had been conditioned to be putting his nose on anything that looked like a target because he was doing it each time. But we have no idea what kind of facility he was in, so we don't know what he was trained for.
The marine mystery made headlines around the world.
This beluga whale found off the coast of Norway.
A beluga whale wearing a harness.
But it was widely thought at the time that the beluga was most likely a spy whale trained by Russia. But that's just been an assumption until now.
I'm 99% sure that he escaped.
This is Dr. Olga Spak. She's just told a new BBC documentary that she believes the whale fled Russian military training.
I can't fully disclose the contacts where I got this information from, but I heard what his nickname was. His nickname was Andriuha. This animal was kind of easy to train. It was inquisitive and active, but at the same time, it had the character that it often did what he wanted to do. It seemed like no one was surprised that it actually just escaped.
But what are the whales being trained to do? Satellite images suggest they're being kept in pens alongside a Russian submarine base near Murmansk.
Here we can see Russian nuclear-powered submarines.
Thomas Nielsen is the editor of Norwegian online newspaper, the Barents Observer.
The location of the beluga whales very close to the submarines and the surface vessels might tell us that they were actually part of a guarding system. They could be considered a kind of underwater guard dogs.
Sadly, there is no happy ending. 2 months ago, the beluga's lifeless body was found floating off the coast of Norway. So had Putin's Russia caught up with the whale that got away? In this case, it appears the answer is no. The Norwegian authorities say Valdemir, or should that be Andruha, died when a stick became lodged in his mouth.
Oh, sorry to hear it. And that was Jonah Fisher, Jonah and a Whale, reporting and unravelling that fishy mystery. And welcome back to NewsHour. Now, parts of Spain are being lashed with yet more heavy rain. Thousands of homes have been evacuated in the south after a red alert was issued for extreme rain and flooding. Schools have been closed in Malaga. Tourist resorts, including Marbella, are expected to take the full force of this latest storm. It comes just 2 weeks after more than 220 people were killed in Valencia by flash flooding there. From Spain, our Europe correspondent Nick Beek has sent this report.
A message blares out from a military vehicle trundling through the streets. More rain is on the way. This alert in the Valencia region, a stark contrast to the lack of warning 2 weeks ago when the deadliest floods in generations hit Spain. This morning, floodwater raced through towns once again, including in the south, in the Malaga area. This time, there were no reported deaths anywhere. But many are still reeling from what happened a fortnight ago around Valencia. No place was harder hit than here, Pai Porta, home to about 25,000 people. 60 were killed in the floods, and 2 weeks on, it's still caked with this layer of mud everywhere you look. There are fire engines, emergency services, the Red Cross, legions of volunteers. And also you see a lot of the estimated 100,000 cars, vehicles that were destroyed in these floods. Some of them are perching where the water picked them up and deposited them at these incredible angles, some vehicles upside down. Others have been scooped up and moved and put in these sort of makeshift car parks of wrecked vehicles. It's nothing compared with the human cost. It was announced today that the bodies of 5-year-old Ethan Matias and 3-year-old Ruben Matias had been found. Last week, their neighbors had told us how the two brothers had been swept away by the torrent, ripped from their dad's arms, after a truck had smashed open a wall to their home. It was like a tsunami, says Juan Ho, showing us a video of the water racing through his street 2 weeks ago. It was only thanks to God I survived. He makes the sign of the cross. He and his sister Lourdes say they've been abandoned by the authorities since and are furious.
This is a shame. We feel abandoned. For 4 days, we didn't see the army coming to help. We need more troops.
The loss has sparked a huge collective effort, while Spain's politicians have been trading in a bitter blame game. But an heroic effort will be required to clear all this up, and it will be needed for many more weeks and months to come to restore Spain's traumatized and shattered communities.
And that was our Europe correspondent, Nick Peake, reporting there from Valencia. US President-elect Donald Trump has picked the serial entrepreneur and world's richest man Elon Musk for a role in government cost-cutting as part of his drive to dismantle bureaucracy. Alongside the biotech investor Vivek Ramaswamy, he will lead a new Department of Government Efficiency. But there are question marks about actually how much power that department will have. Musk does have a record of making massive staff cuts. When he took over Twitter, he cut, there are various estimates, 50% or more of the staff there. Having said that, some of those fired are suing him in court, saying they were cheated out of severance pay, and they've had some favourable rulings. Musk has also long complained about official regulators. Here he is talking about the ills of government red tape in October this year in a campaign rally in Pittsburgh.
And it's just insane that that the SpaceX team can build a giant rocket faster than the government can move paperwork from one desk to another. This extreme overregulation, where there's just new agencies being created every year, they're all doing the same thing, basically. So anyway, we've got to stop this madness.
Well, he's been very involved in the Trump campaign. He was involved in it, and he was on stage at Trump's Madison Square Gardens rally just before the election, speaking to Howard Lutnick, who heads the Trump transition team.
How much do you think we can rip out of this wasted $6.5 trillion Harris-Biden budget?
Well, I think we can do at least $2 trillion.
Yeah!
Yes.
$2
trillion. Your money is being wasted, and the Department of Government Efficiency is going to fix that.
So that's something like a third of government spending. How easy could that be? Is firing people at Twitter easier than firing government officials? Brian Riddell is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. He's also worked in the past with the Conservative Heritage Foundation. He was actually there the lead researcher on the federal budget and spending policy, so he knows about these things. Will Elon Musk be able to make these cuts in the bureaucracy?
It will be extraordinarily difficult to make significant cuts in the federal government, particularly the elimination of one third of the federal government size that Musk has promised. First off, there really isn't that much waste, fraud, and abuse in the federal budget to eliminate that much spending. But also, Musk's work on Twitter, he reduced costs mainly by firing employees. And the federal budget is driven more by the cost of benefits being paid out rather than the cost of federal employees. And cutting benefits to people is politically perilous. There is certainly ways to cut in the federal budget, but it may be less than the target amount.
Yes, well, as you suggest there are two bits to this, isn't there? There's this government spending and then the number of people employed by the government in, as civil servants and officials. Mm-hmm. So let's just deal with the civil servants and officials. I mean, in Twitter, there are people now suing him for severance pay. How difficult is it to fire officials?
Right now, it is nearly impossible to fire federal employees, which is frankly one of the complaints people have, that people who work for the federal government often don't even show up for work and cannot be fired. So this is something that you're going to need congressional legislation to change, to remove some of the civil service protections that kind of make a government job a job for life. Even if they do that, the savings are not particularly enormous from reducing federal employees compared to the size of the budget deficit.
You'd put a number on that. How many people do you think it would be possible to fire if Congress sort of made it possible?
The federal government employs 2.3 million people, which is about the same as it's been for the last 40 years. And 40% of that is military. So even if we eliminated 10% of the federal workforce, that would be about 200,000 employees out of 2 million. The savings would be maybe $40 billion a year out of a budget that currently spends $6.5 trillion and out of a budget deficit that is nearly $2 trillion. So even if you eliminated about one-tenth of the federal employees, you might shave about 3% off of the budget deficit.
Right. And what about the sort of statements we've been hearing of real radical change, like just getting rid of the Department of Education?
Republicans have been promising to eliminate departments like the Department of Education for 40 years, and they really haven't made any progress because there is intense voter opposition to eliminating full departments. The Department of Education may not be popular by itself, but it funds a lot of things that are popular, such as student loans, Pell Grants, which help people afford college, grants to fund disadvantaged poor districts, and grants to fund the education of disabled kids. Congress is highly unlikely to eliminate the Department of Education if it means eliminating all aid to college students, poor and disabled kids. The best that may happen for conservatives might be that the name changes or the functions just get moved to different apartments.
I mean, I take it you come from the conservative side of U.S. politics. You've been with Heritage and Marco Rubio and so on. Do you think that Trump has just overpromised it?
Trump has absolutely overpromised. He has talked a lot about dramatically reducing spending, but he hasn't really specified where he would cut other than eliminating the Department of Education. He has already taken Social Security and Medicare off the table, which are the two programs driving long-term deficits. And we saw during his previous term as president, he added $7.8 trillion in deficits over 4 years from both tax cuts and new spending, as well as pandemic costs. Until Trump is willing to show how he will take on the popular programs like Social Security and Medicare, or even defense and veterans, which are popular but driving budget deficits, you can't take him seriously on reducing the size of government.
What do you then think becomes of Elon Musk? I mean, there he is. Everyone said he's going to do it. You're saying he can't do it. Well, what's going to happen to him?
My worry is that this government efficiency commission will eventually get bogged down in the weeds, because it turns out that eliminating waste is actually very difficult and complicated. You're going into things like consolidating programs, fixing payment systems. I can't imagine Elon Musk having the time or attention to go into those weeds while running Tesla, SpaceX, and Twitter. So I think ultimately we may wind up with some recommendations that are a little more gimmicky and that ultimately don't go anywhere in Washington.
Well, so says Brian Riddell of the Manhattan Institute. Now, as everyone knows, aviation is bad for the climate, contributing around 2.4% of global carbon dioxide emissions. But now a related but relatively unknown issue has come up at the COP29 summit in Baku. the damaging impact of jet vapor trails, those fluffy white lines you can see in the sky behind a plane, also known as condensation trails or contrails. Well, Carlos López de la Osa is from the Transport and Environment Campaign Group in Brussels, and he's carried out a study on this, and it's being discussed in Baku. So, first of all, what are they exactly? How are these trails made, and how do they contribute to the greenhouse effect?
Contrails are formed because planes don't just emit CO2, they also emit huge amounts of water vapor. And this is similar to what we have in a cold winter morning when we breathe out and our water vapor condenses. It's the same thing. So when a plane flies up in the sky and finds a pocket of cold and humid air, the water vapor released by the engine condenses. It's just an artificial cloud that we're creating. And the cloud interacts with the radiation from the Earth, especially the heat that's trying to escape to outer space.
Now then, having seen a vapor trail, we've all seen them. They're very thin, you know, and they go behind a plane. You don't see much of them. I mean, does that have a big effect?
It does. It does indeed. So the effect is of a similar magnitude to the warming effect of CO2 emissions from aviation. So even though they might seem like pretty harmless thin lines, they do have a sizable effect on climate, especially those ones which stay for a long time in the atmosphere and develop into cirrus clouds, so they become a bit thicker.
So what do you think can be done about it? Because apparently there are quite easy fixes for this.
Yeah, so as I've said, they don't form all the time. So if we see planes flying in the sky, we don't always see contrails behind them. But in those specific cold and humid regions, they tend to form more easily. So it would consist of finding those areas and avoiding them in a similar fashion to what we do already today with thunderstorms or with areas of severe turbulence. And that would consist of relatively small deviations going up or down by 300-600 meters, which is a relatively small climb or descent. This will have very limited impact on flight times, or almost no impact, and a very limited impact as well on fuel consumption. But in that way, we can mitigate significantly the formation of contrails.
I mean, that sounds like another surprising claim, that 300 meters could make such a big difference to the air temperature and therefore the capacity to form these trails.
Yeah, those areas are very thin.
Is this science absolutely established, or are there people who challenge you on this?
There's a consensus on the fact that these contrails are very warming for the climate and their impact is of a similar size to that of CO2. The exact extent is still a subject of scientific research. But one thing that we can tell for sure, and we've looked at it in our analysis, is that if we tackle those very few flights which are responsible for the most warming contrails, we're talking about 3% of flights generating 80% of contrail warming, that's certainly a no-regrets solution for climate, which can be also deployed at a very low cost. We're talking less than the cost of a coffee at the airport per passenger.
Right. I mean, it's just a few dollars per head in each flight. Are people taking it seriously?
There has been quite a lot of attention from the climate community and also by policymakers, and that is precisely what we want to achieve by talking about it and presenting it at COP, because so far it's been a very niche topic in the aviation community, but it's really a significant climate issue which has so far flown under the radar, but at the same time is one climate issue that has a relatively easy fix, which will have no impact on the aviation industry and on passengers. So that's why it's such an attractive solution, and we want more and more people to be aware of it.
Now, you're talking about, they're called contrails, and I think we should just mention, because lots of people will have seen this online and therefore just be wondering if it's connected, which it isn't, but that there's talk online, a conspiracy theory about chemtrails, which are the same thing. It's a different word for the same thing. And there are all sorts of ideas about what chemtrails are meant to be, which are all basically not based in reality, right?
Yeah, so quite often reality is simpler than it seems. So as opposed to having some chemicals being equipped on aircraft and released to spray population, it's much simpler. It's what we said before. It's quite simply the water vapor condensing behind planes on certain areas of the atmosphere. So luckily, we're not being sprayed. There's a climate issue, but we also have the toolkit to start solving it very soon.
So not chemtrails, but contrails there. That was Carlos López de la Osa. You're listening to NewsHour, and here in the UK, Samantha Harvey has won this year's prestigious Booker Prize for Fiction for her book Orbital. It is set during a 24-hour period on the International Space Station. It's a short book, just 136 pages, so rather easier maybe than many Booker Prize winners, and it explores the relationship that human beings have not really with space, but with the planet Earth. Now, Samantha Harvey has never been to space, but those who've read Orbital say she has described it very vividly. Not that they've been either, I suppose, but anyway, Rebecca Kesby asked how she managed to do that.
I mean, in a sense, this is kind of the novelist stock in trade. This is what we do. We just imagine ourselves to places. So people are now living in space. We have, as a species, been living there for a quarter of a century, and I really wanted to do justice to their experience and to try to get it right. So there's so much information about the ISS online.
The International Space Station.
And the spacecraft in my novel is sort of an International Space Station, which is clearly very closely mapped to the International Space Station. Mm. But I wanted to give myself that slight latitude. It didn't have to be exactly the same.
And just briefly, that you did sort of write most of it during lockdown, didn't you? When everyone was so constrained as to what they could do, and yet you're writing about this vast universe and, infinity and that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, in a sense, sort of half of what you're doing is writing about the kind of agoraphobic expanse of space and the fact that the four astronauts and two cosmonauts in my novel are detached from the rest of humanity, but they are also in a very confined space. So I found myself writing quite a lot of it in lockdown, and it was a very, very apposite book to be writing then, because I was on one hand writing about confinement and six people who can't reach back to their loved ones. Mm. In the book, one of the astronauts' mother dies, and she obviously can't get back to the funeral. So there was something that seemed quite kind of true to human experience, lived experience at that time. Yeah. And then on the other hand, every day I was able to undertake this incredible, beautiful journey of escapism.
Away from lockdown.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it made my lockdown feel a lot more expansive than it might otherwise.
You mentioned the characters in the book, and for our programme it's fascinating because they're drawn from all over the world. You've got an Italian, someone from Japan, America, Russia. Was that also the kind of international element that you were hoping to get, in terms of world citizens as they're peering out of the space station looking back to Earth?
Yeah, I wanted the makeup of the crew to be somewhat credible so that it could be potentially a crew that would exist on the ISS. I think something that really draws me to the ISS as a project is the fact of its internationalism and its symbol of, not just a symbol, but it's an incredible symbol of cooperation between nations. Mm. And it was a sort of response to the end of the Cold War and some effort at a new dawn, a new way of Russia and the West working together. Mm. It has 17, I think, contributing nations. And I love that about it. And I think that there's something quite poignant about the fact that the ISS will be deorbited in a few years. And of course, relations now between Russia and the West have completely collapsed. And there's something there that I wanted to point at, sort of this, like a nostalgic saying goodbye to this amazing spacecraft that has been born of peace and peaceful cooperation. Mm. And we're now in an era, I fear, that is beyond that.
And the focus, as I mentioned, is the Earth, isn't it? They're sort of looking back, they're communicating back with the Earth, they're viewing it from a view that, well, you've never had, even though you're writing about it, most of us never have. And what was your message with that?
Well, I don't know if I had a message as such, but I try to write from some kind of emotional center in myself, I suppose. I'm not a great planner when it comes to writing, but I do have a strong sense of what I want the book to feel like, what I want its sentiment to be, I guess. And with this book, from the outset, I knew that I wanted its sentiment to be one of wonder or joy, rapture, all of those things. I wanted it to feel ultimately open and breathless and sort of alive and expansive.
The book is called Orbital, obviously, as we mentioned, but it takes place in the course of one day, which I guess is one circle around the Earth. Have I got that? No, there's several, I think.
Yes, right? Yes, so it's one day, so it's 24 hours, but it's 16 transits, full transits around the Earth. Mm. So in that one 24-hour period, the astronauts, in fact, have 16 days and 16 nights. The book wasn't originally set over one day. It was over a longer period, and I was really struggling with how to articulate the bizarreness, as I imagined it, the bizarreness of time being exploded in this way while you're in orbit. And it was only when I understood that I could set it over one day and sort of encode that strangeness into the structure of the book.
Yeah.
I thought, oh, of course, that's how it should be. And once I decided on that, it really came together quite quickly and it aligned. It's complicated because I had a set of 16 orbits mapped out, and I had to follow them really closely. So if I wanted in one section to, you know, talk about what was happening with a typhoon that's hitting the Philippines in the day in the novel, but they weren't over the Philippines at that time, they were in fact over Western Europe, then that was just as it was. I couldn't change that. Yeah. I wanted to be true to the actual orbits of that day. So my view was always confined to where they would be at that point over the Earth. So I had sort of complicated maps and diagrams.
It sounds fascinating. And you must have learned so much about space in the course of writing this book. Have you always been interested in space? And would you fancy going there yourself?
Well, I've always been interested in space, but in quite a limited way. I'm interested in space insofar as it affords us a perspective to look back at ourselves. That's what sort of interests me. Mm. Would I go there? I want to say yes, but in reality, I think probably no.
Stay on Earth.
Yes. I think it's... I've probably been as close to space in this book as I'm going to get.
Feet firmly planted on the ground despite her Booker Prize win. Congratulations to Samantha Harvey, talking there to Rebecca Kesby, and they bring us to an end of this edition of NewsHour. So thanks very much for listening, and from Owen Bennett-Jones here in London, goodbye.